This Rock Talk podcast recording is an interview and opinion product that is the property of rocksubculture.com, all rights reserved. Rocksubculture.com is not responsible for any statements or opinions expressed by the guests of this program. Welcome to Rock Talk, the official podcast for rocksubculture.com. Each podcast features interviews with special guests to discuss all aspects of popular music. Rocksubculture.com travels the globe to experience, review, and archive live concert events. Interview those involved in producing and performing a variety of genres of popular rock music, as well as find and learn about related studio and stage-used artifacts and memorabilia. Now, let's join our host, Jason DeBoard.
So, welcome to Rock Talk, and today my guest is Clive Farrington from When in Rome, UK. So I want to welcome you and thank you for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much, Jason. Yeah, not a problem.
And I had the pleasure of seeing you last week at the Crest Theatre in Sacramento as part of the...
I think it's the Lost 80s Live, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Lost 80s Live. So
I know it off by heart now.
So that was an awesome show, and I know you've been doing a series of these, and some of the artists have changed that you've been touring with. So do you want to maybe talk a little bit about your experience doing these shows?
It's just that, I mean, obviously it's an eye-opener for me, and I'm actually touring with my heroes, as it were, the people that I grew up with in music, and we're a massive influence. Particularly Flock of Seagulls, who are they're from Liverpool. We're from Manchester, about 30 miles away from where I'm from. Mm-hmm. So the kind of musical upbringing for both bands, for Flock of Seagulls and When in Rome, was very, very similar.
Right.
But we were all in the same scene and growing up in the Hacienda days, you know, in the New Order days, the acid house period and everything else just went after that. So we all grew up in the same time scale, if you like, and it's just great. And I never met them while I was in the UK,
and it's so weird
that we come out on tour in the US and we meet for the first time, if you like.
How funny.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk a little bit about When in Rome, and then we can kind of go back into your own upbringing and how you got into music and stuff. So currently you're touring as When in Rome UK, Why don't you tell me about who's involved in that?
Well, When in Rome UK came about because of the situation is at the moment that when we first formed, we formed the band with Michael Floreal, myself and Andrew Mann. And we parted ways in 1991 with Mike. We felt that the direction wasn't going in the right way for us. Andrew and I wanted to go somewhere else. Mike wanted to go his own way. So, we decided to part ways. We kept the band going. We toured again in Brazil with a new keyboard player, and we stayed writing together all the way through that period up to today. And of course, now we find ourselves in a situation where Mike has formed the success of the movie in 2004, Napoleon Dynamite, meant that there was a question to the, you know, they were asking for us to tour again.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike, without us knowing, formed a band here in the US and started to tour on the success of the movie. Of course, we were kind of stuck back in the UK and not having an agent out here and not knowing really much about it until 2006, when we started seeing YouTube videos of Mike's version of the band performing our tunes. And, you know, without wanting to go to a slanging max, it just didn't sound like When in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of pricked my, it got my goat, and I started to get a little bit itchy about it and started to inquire what was going on and, whether there was a chance for us to tour, because we'd never ever quit the band. We kept the band going, we kept writing, and we were kind of aghast at the fact that the band had reformed without the original singers and writers. So I don't know whether that answers your question, but I don't really want to go into slanging match. Obviously, I don't mind speaking about what's going on with Mike at the moment, but I don't really want to start saying how, you know,
sure,
that needs the detail, if you like.
Yeah. So now, currently, you have Rob Juarez also performing with you.
Yeah.
And your guitarist,
Danny Dean.
Jumpin' Danny Dean, right?
Oh, Jumpin' Danny Dean. Yeah, yeah. Fantastic.
And then
you mentioned Rob and stuff like that. You know the background to all of this. That Rob was actually the agent for When in Rome back for Mike's version of When in Rome.
Uh huh.
Because when he asked Mike, it was actually Rob that asked Mike to whether he was interested in reforming the band because of the success of the movie. Now Mike told Rob that we'd retired and we couldn't sing anymore, so. Rob had no choice but to put this band together, that band together. But then I contacted Rob, and then the cat was out of the bag, if you like. And but you know, the main reason why Rob is involved with us now is because he's a fantastic percussion player.
Yeah,
he's a great backing vocalist, and I wouldn't have anybody involved that wasn't up to scratch in the lineup. And Rob is really, really a massive asset to the band.
Yeah, and you also are touring with two ladies that are on string instruments as well.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never worked with strings before, and it's such a pleasure to work with them. And they are absolutely so professional. It's unbelievable. You know, we've not had a load of rehearsal time. It's been very, very quick. You know, we've had about 3 or 4 days rehearsal. But they've really, really, you know, you don't really have to rehearse with them. They just bang on every time. You just have to hum a tune, hum the way it goes, and they can do it straight off. And they're very, very, very professional, and I feel really comfortable singing in front of them. We played the New Wave Bar last night in Bellflower, which is a very, very small club, and it was their first birthday. And in that room, in a small room, the string sounded absolutely fantastic. It sounded like a full orchestra, if you like,
wow,
especially coming through the PA.
Yeah, because I know the Crest has really high ceilings, so I'm sure it must have sounded a lot different in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Going back to when you guys started the band, now you were in a different band before When in Rome, right? Was it called Beaulieu?
Beaulieu, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, now, how did that come about? How did you get interested in music and forming that band?
You know, I went to the root of the Working Men's Club. I was in a band called Atlantis. I was in a band called Glass. We did all the Working Men's Clubs. We got chucked out of Working Men's Clubs for doing our own. We always insisted on doing our own songs.
Yeah,
and of course, you know, most people don't take to that because they want to hear stuff they know. So we did all of that. We did all the breaking down on the motorway and getting there, you know, having to get to the gigs and everything else. And so I guess I've done like a full on apprenticeship in music. But after all of that, after doing all the Working Men's Clubs, I formed a band with a fella by the name of, Dave Powell, who's a really, really good frontman and great guitarist, great songwriter. And, I started writing with him in the band Beaulieu, and we did all tours around. We just toured and toured and toured. Again, it was we did all our own stuff, and we did some very, very rough places, and I really don't know how we got away with it with the makeup that we all wore. It was,
yeah. So what time period was this? Like the mid '80s, or?
Yeah, this was I would say up to about 90. In fact, it was like a smooth transition from Beaulieu into When in Rome. It went from, say, 1981 with Beaulieu up to 85, 86, where we disbanded Beaulieu and we went for the smooth transition into When in Rome, because Andrew Mann, who's actually joining us later on in the year on the tour, because he just got married.
Okay.
He was supporting us as a punk. You know, have you heard of John Cooper Clarke?
No.
Well, he's a punk poet. We had this period in England where we had the punk poets who used to support bands, and they used to go up and sit and talk poems, if you like.
Okay.
But they were very, very, very cutting edge poems. They weren't the normal flowery. hence the name punk poet. It was like they were talking of the times of the moment, you know, anti-government and all that sort of stuff. So Andrew was one of those kind of poets, and he supported us. And with When in Rome, when I decided to form When in Rome, I needed a lyricist.
Right.
And so Andrew came on board. We wrote the song The Promise. That was in my mum and dad's garden shed. And I wrote the first verse, I wrote the chorus, and then I get really lazy with songwriting. I like to write first verse, chorus, and then I hand it over to somebody else to finish off. And that's the way we did it with all the songs, including The Promise.
Yeah, so with The Promise, you know, I've always wondered, watching the music video, is that sort of really how the vocal parts got switched out between you, kind of how it's seen in the video, or is that more just for the purposes of the video? Like, how did you break out the vocal parts for that song?
Well, when you see it in the video, Andrew's singing my vocal.
Okay.
As you probably know. And that's because I'm a very, very reluctant pop star. I didn't really fancy being Andrew was the front man back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, when we first started, he was the front man. He got all the record deals. He did all the blagging with all the people, blah, blah, blah. He used to do all the running around with all the demos and everything else. So I just said to him, you know, you might as well do it. You're the front man. You go on the video. But you know what? I think that's quite a story as well. Quite a nice story as well. It kind of adds a juxtaposition to the video, if you like, and it makes people question it, if you like.
Right, right.
And I'm not the sort of person that wants to jump all over a video and go, this is me. so that's the way it turned out. I said, you're the front man. You do the vocal. And that's it. And it's very, very similar to the way Tears for Fears were as well. You know, that we always thought that it was the other fella that did, you know, the bass player,
right?
That did the vocal, but it wasn't. It was Roland who did all the really cool vocals. Weirdly, sound a little bit When in Rome-ish.
Yeah, well, I just saw them a couple of weeks ago and had front row seats. It's the first time I'd ever seen them, so it was really fascinating to me to see them perform live, because you always kind of wonder, like, who's singing which bits, you know.
And it's Roland that does know most of the singing. The guitarist, isn't it? I don't know whether he's got curly hair now, but
yeah,
he did that back in the day.
Yeah. What was the thinking behind When in Rome and having kind of two lead vocalists, you know, as part of a band? Because that is kind of a little unusual, you know, for rock and pop music.
We were very, very influenced by the Walker Brothers.
Okay.
And that's where that came from. And Everly Brothers, and you know, it was always the harmonies were the important thing. And you know, with When in Rome, it's a weird thing. We sound very different when we're singing alone, solo.
Uh-huh.
When it comes together, when we sing together, it becomes more. I know that I'm doing the tour on my own at the moment, and it's obviously still better. Sounds like When in Rome.
Yeah.
It's even more When in Rome when Andrew sings with me, because it just has that different sound. It's obviously two different people singing together. It just adds that very, very unique sound, as in the Walker Brothers, you know. And also Jacques Brel, there's an album out Scott Walker did called Scott Sings Jacques Brel. And the songs on there are absolutely brilliant. And both Andrew and I were listening to that album when we were forming the band. We were both listening to that album at the same time.
Hmm.
And it was a massive, massive influence. And he used harmonies. Obviously, he was on his own at that point. That was a solo album, but he harmonized to himself, and it sounded absolutely, it's exactly what we want, how we wanted to sound.
Hmm. Now, when you guys wrote that song, was the objective to write like a really strong hooky pop song, or did it also?
No, not at all.
No.
It was, it's hard to even know now how it came about. I mean, we used to, as I said, it was in my mum and dad's garden, so we had this tiny little studio there that my dad had converted, and he put all the soundproofing in, everything else. It was tiny, so we had to have the keyboards on the wall. The mixer was on the wall. They were on special brackets, so they were against the wall rather than being horizontal, if you like. They were vertical on the walls to save space. And we used to write in there. We just used constantly mess around with ideas and melodies, and mainly the melody, you know, without blowing my own trumpet, mainly melodies come out of my head. I'll dream about something. I'll think about something. I'll hum it into a little dictation machine and then play it. And that's exactly how we wrote. And that's how that melody line at the beginning of the promise came about. I just hummed that. I said, Mike, try something like that. And he played that piano part, and it just came about. And weirdly enough, it was, I kind of knew when I'd written it, I kind of knew there was something there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you never know how it's going to go and how big it has become, if you like.
Right. Now, did the lyrics have any special meaning to you, or was it more just about composing something that sounded good?
Well, you know what? I'd like to answer both. Yeah, I mean, both. But the important thing for me was the sound.
Mm-hmm.
That from the beginning, it's the sound of the vocal, sound of the... We used to use a Roland 501 for the echo, which is the old Roland tape echo, which was absolutely fantastic. That on the demo, that was what we used on the four-track demo for The Promise. And that, I've got to say, the four-track demo sounds even better than the four... I've not got it anymore, but I'd say it sounds better than the 48-track finished version.
Oh, really?
Because of the freshness of it, because it was the first time we did, we captured it. We captured a moment on a little Tascam four-track machine. And it really did sound, well, to me, it did. Probably if I listened to it now, it just wouldn't, but it felt like it did at the time. The sounds, the drum track that I programmed the drums on the Lin drum. You can actually tell that now. I've got a Lin drum now on my little iPod, a little Lin drum copy thing that you just, and I checked it against the rhythm the other day and it sounds exactly right. So.
Oh, wow.
So, it was the rhythm of the drums, the melody, everything else. And I suppose the actual content of the lyrics was the last thing on my mind, although it must be something to do with how I feel and, you know, how I felt at the time, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes across as just a very optimistic song. And really, I mean, it's just so carried by the vocals. Like, you know, I really love the piano keyboard, but it's pretty minimalist, you know, compared.
Yeah.
It's really carried by the vocals, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Now, that's the song that got you guys your record deal, right?
Yeah.
Did you have any of those other songs done at the time, or did that song like get you the record deal and then you worked on the full album?
It not only got us one record deal, it got us two record deals. We were signed to Elektra first in 1987, sometime around then.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an office in London, and for some reason they signed Simply Red, and Simply Red had that album, whatever the first album was called, ready to go. And, we'd done demos with them. We'd done demos with Elektra, but for some reason they decided to switch back to the US. They'd opened an office in London for 6 months. We signed to them, and then they decided to go back to the US, and it was really difficult to deal with them because of the time difference and everything else.
Right.
So we spoke to them about that. We expressed our concerns, and they said, right, we'll allow you to go. And luckily for, I mean, Andrew's, you know, I've got to give Andrew his credit. He'd already teed up another record deal in readiness for if we did have to leave Elektra, if you like.
Wow.
And Virgin was still interested, so we did a couple of showcases for them at Nomis in London, and signed to Virgin.
And then I know the music video wasn't as big in the later 80s as it was in the beginning, but was that like a key thing that they wanted you to do right away, was shoot a video for that song?
Yeah, you know what? And they spent so much money on video. I think we did about 5 videos in total.
Uh-huh.
We just went from one song to the next in a really short period of time. And it was in the days when they were throwing a lot of money into video and stuff. So we were lucky enough to be able to experience being on these massive stage sets and stuff, and having Roman amphitheaters built for us and everything else.
You'd mentioned Napoleon Dynamite, that your song The Promise was obviously a key feature in that movie, and that came out in, I think, 2004. So what was that like for you to have this song kind of come back and have sort of a resurgence many, many years later?
I mean, it's really hard to explain how, because I remember the day when Mike called me, and I think it was in 2003 he called me, he said they're interested in using the film, the song for the film, and obviously I'm over the moon and I'm excited, and I'm thinking, no, they're not, you know, so the first thing you think is, no, they're just inquiring, you know, they're just seeing if they can, you know, obviously I've never had a song used in a film before. And of course it went through and we did all the negotiations and everything else. And, the best thing about it is when all your friends say it's just been on telly and we've just seen your name at the end of the credits. it's hard to explain the excitement that I had when, Mike first told me, and then when it was used, and then when I watched it for the first time, because I didn't really watch it straight away. Or, you know, the greatest thing was I was watching telly in bed one night. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and Daryl Hannah, I'm watching the MTV Movie Awards. Uh-huh. Daryl Hannah runs up on stage. She says, forgive me, I'm out of breath, and I'm losing a voice shouting for Napoleon Dynamite. So I kind of knew that if Daryl Hannah gives it a thumbs up,
yeah,
I'm happy. And then obviously went on to win the MTV Film of the Year in 2004.
Well, it's just funny because your music to me, like when I listen to it, it totally seems like it should be in a John Hughes movie, like, you know, from earlier in the 80s or something. It just has kind of that spirit and vibe to it, you know?
Absolutely. We've got a few things going on at the moment. There's a new film coming out called Live for Today that's used it as well. I noticed on my, I was looking at my publishing company. We have a portal on the publishing company that tells us what's going on, and there's a film called Live for Today that's coming out that's used it.
Oh, cool.
There's a new program in America, a new television series in America called Psych Out.
Uh-huh.
That's used it as well. And then in an advert, the Gant clothing label, they've used that in an advert for Christmas. So there's a few things going on with it.
Yeah. Now, what have you done outside of music and outside of When in Rome since the late 80s?
Well, my daughter was born in 1999, so it was kind of time to get up off my backside and get a proper job, as it were, because When in Rome wasn't paying the way up to 2004.
Right.
Because of film and everything else. So I got myself a job in the best place possible. It was at a hotel looking after event technology.
Oh, cool.
So it was kind of doing the job that I like. The thing that I love most about the music industry is being in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And lighting and audio and everything to do with it. All the technology that goes around it. So I decided to get myself a job where that's what I was doing every day. So I was looking after major events at a big hotel at Manchester Airport.
So then, you know, since you're kind of into the technology side, what are your thoughts on how much that's changed, you know, in the last 20 something years as far as recording music, making music, distributing music, you know, all of the above? I'd say
for a musician, it's the best time ever.
Mm-hmm.
Because anybody can actually do it. I mean, I was watching a video of my daughter the other day. She put up on YouTube that she was singing some a Miley Cyrus song. But if you can do that, I mean, it's the Andy Warhol whole thing, isn't it? He coins people mm-hmm. 15 minutes of fame.
Right.
Now they've got more than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
They've got endless amounts of time for fame. So if you've got something that's good, you can put it up there. And if it is good, people will take to it and by that hopefully become successful.
And do you feel also, since it's so much easier to travel and people have more reach, you know, with the internet, communicating with each other and everything, do you think that music today, like, you know, back in the 80s, the bands that were recording in the UK had kind of a generally distinctive sound that might have been different from the US? Do you think that's kind of blurred now, more that things have become a little more, you know, international?
I think so. Yeah. the bands that I've listened to over the past couple of years. I've been getting more into the American side of things, and weirdly enough, Texas seems to be really good on the electronic music scene. A place where you think that there's more line dancing.
Right, and cowboy hats and boots.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we first went there, obviously you get the line dancing clubs and everything else like that, but then you get the juxtaposition of real electro clubs. I mean, I know that Depeche Mode are massive in Texas. Mm-hmm. Erasure are massive in Texas. And then, of course, you get the offshoots of the bands that form themselves with influences around Depeche Mode and Erasure. Mm-hmm. And so there's a really, really, really good electronic scene in the US at the moment.
Yeah. Now, you know, in the 80s, I think a lot of people that weren't into, you know, more of the synthesizer and keyboard based music maybe saw it as more of a fad. And then it seemed like in the early 90s, you know, you kind of have the grunge movement coming and some of that went away. But now it seems like electronic music, anything with synthesizer and, you know, programmed music is more popular than ever. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
It was, to me, it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Because there seems to be, to me, more melody in synthesizer music than there is in grunge music. You know,
right.
There's a lot of stuff like that I can't listen to. Yeah, there's the odd thing, you know, the odd hit record that comes about in like heavy rock or grunge or whatever you want to call it. But for me, the stuff that's really memorable and you just want to listen to over and over again is that pumping beat with a melody. And I think that's what wins out at the end of the day. And if you hear a great melody on the radio, right, and against a heavy guitar,
right,
I think they win on the melody every time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, there's all kinds of music, I think, where there's sort of this electric guitar playing sort of gymnastics, where it's really impressive that they can play the guitar like that, but it doesn't really grab me at all, because it, to me, at some point, it just sort of becomes sound, like a wall of sound.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But you know what? The clever electronic bands are using that, the guitar as well. Depeche Mode are probably the best at it.
Yeah.
Where they use guitar with great effect. And weirdly enough, they use kind of Danny Dean, but he's got that sound. It's that twangy, the shadows, if you like. Hank Marvin, is it Hank Marvin, that guitar player? That kind of twangy guitar sound works really well against electronic music.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like Martin, I mean, Depeche Mode is actually like my all-time favorite band, and like Martin,
mine as well.
Martin Gore, like he just comes up with these great little guitar riffs, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not super complicated, but it's just that repetitive. You know,
absolutely.
At the key places, especially live, it's just, you know, some of those songs, they just blow them out, and it's just incredible.
Enjoy the Silence. Sprung to mind then, because we had that down as a cover number about 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
But then decided that Depeche Mode did it miles better than we did. But the guitar riff in that is absolutely stunning, and it's simple, it's brilliant, and it's like you say, it's out of the head of a genius.
Yeah, yeah. So, what are you guys working on now as far as new music?
Well, I've got about 4 or 5 demos ready to go. We're going to be recording at Lakewood. We recorded the new tune, Fatal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we recorded Fatal at Danny Dean's studio in Lakewood, and we're going in there next week to put some new stuff down. I've got a new track called Lost, and that seems to be the strongest one out of the 5 that I've got demos for at the moment.
Cool. How much longer are you guys going to be doing live dates?
Oh, as long as we can stand up.
Yeah.
And even when we're not standing up.
Yeah. Now, you're going to be here in the U.S. through the end of this month. Is that right?
We go back on the 4th of September. Yeah, we do 2 shows in Hawaii.
Oh, cool.
The 31st of this month and the 1st of September. And then we go back, and then I'm coming back towards the end of September, and then we've got some shows going through November and December.
Okay, cool. Well, it was awesome to talk to you. And like I said, I really enjoyed seeing you guys play live, and I hope to see you again soon with some of those other great bands you've been touring with too. It's a nice bonus when you can see, you know, six awesome bands in one night. But, you know, for me, I've always been a big fan, and I honestly didn't know if I'd ever get a chance to see you guys live. So it was a real treat to finally experience that.
Means a lot.
Yeah. So, I really appreciate you taking the time, and, hopefully we can stay in touch, and I'll keep track of what you guys are up to.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jason.
Oh, you're welcome.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our program, Rock Talk. For the latest gig archives, articles, and features about popular music and concert events around the world, please visit us online at www.rocksubculture.com.
Even say Moose Busters.